Richard Garriott, the self-made computer game tycoon with a very everyday wish to follow in his father's footsteps. However, in Richard's case, his father's footsteps lead all the way to outer space as part of the last Apollo mission to Skylab. Well, mission accomplished. Richard returned to Earth last week after a trip to the International Space Station. Our man Ian Sample went to meet him. Ian, what was he doing when you saw him?
He was wandering around in his spacesuit, actually. he's been back a week. When I first met him, he was wearing his spacesuit. And I asked at the reception of the hotel I was meeting him whether they'd seen anyone walking around in one. And then I got a call saying he was a little bit late. But he's been back a week. He's looking incredibly well. And he's clearly a man changed by being in space. The way he talks about it, the way he kind of thinks before he tries to explain how it's had an effect on him. And he actually said, look, he read so much about how space has an effect on you that he became very skeptical, and he didn't think there'd be anything interesting to say about it whatsoever when he got back. But he's very eloquent, and he's just fascinating to listen to about all of this. So, Richard, last time we spoke, you were preparing to go in space. Very good to see you back in one piece. How was it?
You know, it is fantastic. It was fantastic. And, it was so recent to go. As you know, I only landed about a week ago, so it's still very fresh in my mind, and I'm still enjoying it, you might say.
So for those of you out there who haven't heard our previous interview, can you just explain how you got to go up there?
Sure. I have been investing towards achieving the goal of getting myself into space for almost 30 years. And Space Adventures, which is a company that is, in fact, the only company that has sent, now I'm the sixth person we've put into space, I also happen to be the vice chairman of the board of, so I'm sort of an insider, you might say. But again, my goal in helping form the company and invest in it was, at a personal level, to find my own way there. And it's also interesting to note that, you know, 6 years ago when we flew Dennis Tito, I was actually scheduled to be that first person originally, and it was the internet stock market bubble that took that option away from me. And so I've been working very hard to rebuild my financial empire, so to speak, to find my way there now.
So everybody's going to want to know what happens on launch day. How do you prepare? What's it like to be a passenger on Soyuz? You went with the Russians.
Now actually with me on the flight was an American astronaut, Mike Fink, who was the Soyuz engineer, and Russian commander, Yuri Lonchakov. And I sat in the right seat, which is what they call the cosmonaut researcher seat. So, when you use the word passenger, it's important to note that on the space shuttle, there are seats which are truly passengers. You have no controls and no view of any kind. You're right back on the middeck. But on the Soyuz, everyone has work to do, including myself. So that's why I had to spend, or one of the reasons I had to spend, almost 9 months in Russia training to make sure I knew, how to, what the commands were and what the buttons and switches were, and knew how to react in what are often described as off-nominal situations, when there's a malfunction, basically, yeah, of one kind or another. And but the ride up and the ride back on a Soyuz was fantastic. Sitting on a tiny little capsule on the top of a giant stack of liquid oxygen and kerosene for fuel is pretty exciting, just to walk up the stairs, much less light it up. Although it's very smooth and very elegant, I often describe it as kind of a ballet, a very powerful but comfortable and confident ballet. The return trip on Soyuz is a little more raucous. You come in as a fireball through the ionosphere, and you can see that very clearly out the windows as the heat shields are ablating around you. When the parachutes open, you get tossed about a fair bit, and bits and pieces that aren't held down well scatter about the cabin. And when you finally do touch down on the ground, they don't usually like to use the word impact, but frankly, it's an impact. You're hitting what feels like about 30 miles an hour in a 6-ton vehicle into the very solid earth, and so it is like a very violent car crash. But you're in a very well-developed seat that is specifically molded to your body and has this crushable shock absorber in it, so you actually are not injured or bruised in any way. But the violence around you in the spacecraft is quite notable.
But just take us back to that, the moment in the morning. Can you give people an impression of what the capsule's like on the inside? Is this very cramped? How many of you are in there? And then what can you see when they sort of light the candle, if you like?
Well, the space capsule is very, very close quarters. Not only are you sitting shoulder to shoulder, but if you're in the center seat, you could easily touch the left and right walls. And the control panel is within reach in front of you. And your feet are touching the outer surface, of one side, and your head is really against the parachute compartments, but otherwise against the other outer wall. For example, if you had to change seats with each other, there's not really enough space to switch seats as a case study. And in fact, you're so cramped in there. One thing that does go through at least my mind is that if there was some emergency that required you to get out of there quickly, you're not getting out of there quickly. And so you just hope you don't encounter that particular kind of an emergency. When you climb up to board the Soyuz, that day, I'd been in it a couple of times before, but this was the first time it was fully fueled. And the liquid oxygen is loaded very, very cold in order to keep it in that liquid state. And so the entire spacecraft is covered with white frost, and it's so cold that any air that's coming anywhere near it not only condenses more of this frost, but then descends down the sides of the vehicle in a kind of a condensation smoke. So there's the whole vehicle is smoking with this downward flow of smoke down into the pit below it. And once you get on board, during the first phases of launch, there's a fairing around the space capsule, so you can't actually see out any windows. But while you're sitting there, there's a 40-minute lull before they light it up. And you can actually sit there as you're sitting there, you can feel the wind causing it to sway just a little bit. Since there's no commands during that 40 minutes, Mission Control actually plays what I would describe as elevator music, and which I thought was quite funny, because here we are in our elevator to the sky and we're listening to elevator music. And we'd all done this, we'd rehearsed this so many times, we all just closed our eyes and you really could relax very comfortably and, basically fall asleep there, just minutes before launch. But then, once the 5-minute bell strikes, you get very busy. 5 seconds before launch, you feel the whole thing. You begin to feel pumps and valves click and clack, open and shut, and the engines start up, and you feel the thrust. And then exactly on the second on time, you lift up into the sky.
How does that feel? Is it? Do you feel this a big? Do you get forced back in your seat? Do you feel that acceleration? And can you see much, or do you just see the sky go sort of blue to black?
Well, at first, like I mentioned, you can't see out the windows.
Yeah.
And the thrust that you feel begins, the initial acceleration is extremely gentle. And so it's not like you pop the clutch on a sports car and suddenly you're thrown back to the back of the seat. On the other hand, though, the acceleration increases very steadily. And so, well, at first you don't really feel any, you feel movement, but not really any pressure. That slight pressure begins to build up and up and up and up and up to where you get up to the point where you're about, 3 or 4 G's of pressure, but it's all through your chest into your back, which is a very comfortable way to take that kind of pressure, more comfortable than a loop on a roller coaster, for example. And then you go through the staging events where, there's a snap, crackle, pop, and, one set of motors falls off and another one lights up. And those are also, again, very snappy in the sense of they're very instantaneous, very comfortable. And even though we did this on a centrifuge, the reality is actually much smoother even than the centrifuge ride. And then you get up to an altitude where you're out of most of the atmosphere, so they pop the fairings off that have been covering the orbital module, which is something that, pre-launch you look at these and these are massive fairings covering this thing. And the way they pull them off is they have basically an air brake that folds out. It makes a 4-foot square panel that folds out, which is going to catch a lot of air, obviously, and that just rips these fairings off the sides of this thing. And so you look at that and go, just tremendous speeds and tremendous forces involved in this, and it's just a little pop, and they're gone. You don't perceive them peeling away at all. They're just pow, gone. And immediately you can see the view, and you're still initially low enough to perceive that you're in the atmosphere, so to speak, but not for long. You're very quickly, your view transitions to the blackness of space. The ability to see the thickness of the atmosphere, the clouds, your initial orbit is actually pretty low. And, you really only feel like if an airplane feels like you're maybe twice as high as the clouds, that initial orbit only feels, 5 or 10 times as high as the clouds. And so you're really struck by the fact that, wow, it's amazing that there's no air here to slow us down. And you're struck by, or at least I was struck by, the fact that this orbit, this initial orbit, better be very precise. It has to be perfectly circular because you're not very far above the sky. And so if you have any, misshape to your orbit, you're going to encounter the atmosphere on the backside of the planet and re-enter when you don't plan on it. And, of course, they do this very well, and they've done it many times. So you in fact, have reached a very precise orbit.
So you can see the curvature of the Earth. You can see, I mean, I'm wondering at any point before docking to the ISS, do you get any sense of the planet, I suppose, of being able to see some of these big features, the continents going by?
Absolutely. Even out that your first view of the window, you can immediately begin to have this kind of new impression of the scale and scope of the planet. And that's only continued to be reinforced. You know, the more you look out the window, and once we got to the ISS, of course, spent lots of time at the window. I've always heard about how the view from space really changes people's perspective on the Earth. And so I've heard that so many times that I was actually kind of skeptical that it would really impress me in that way, just because it seems like such well-trodden ground. However, I have to tell you, it's really true. And it affected me in ways that, I haven't heard people describe before, but I'm sure, we all just use different words to describe this impression. But some of those impressions are things like, on the one hand, it's clear you're very, very high. Because you can see the curvature of the Earth, and because you can see how thin the atmosphere is in comparison to the diameter of the Earth. And there's colors, you can see gradations, so to speak, in the atmosphere that you really just can't take pictures of. You can see it easily by eye, but no matter how hard you try to take pictures of it, it's just too subtle to really capture. But if you look straight down at the Earth, you can see airplane contrails, you can see the wakes of boats, you can see bridges and major roadways easily. The man-made objects you can see, I was actually stunned by just how it really didn't feel that different than being in an airplane when you look straight down. But you're also traveling at 17,000 miles an hour. And so when you pass over a large metropolitan area, or in my case, I had a lot of daylight passes across the continental United States. You know, it takes 8 minutes to cross the entire United States. And you'd pass over a big city like San Francisco or Los Angeles in, a minute. But then you would go through a very brief lull before you might hit another big city like, say, Phoenix. And then another slight lull or pass over some desert before you might hit, Houston. And then you're back over the Gulf. And you realize how close together all the cities are. And I don't mean just in the sense of time. I mean that you can actually see the population has nearly met, between those areas. And in fact, all of the what I'll call fertile areas of the Earth are pretty well populated at this point. And a lot of the not terribly fertile areas of the Earth, like the middle of deserts, they're pumping water out of the ground and have really major agricultural concerns going, even in, far-flung parts of the world. And you look at the geological processes of the Earth, of how it was formed and even how wind and weather is eroding it and rebuilding it, and you get a much easier sense of how this grand scale architecture has played out over time. And even weather systems are the same way. You don't see a local weather system. You really see this grand continuous event where you might be able to perceive how moisture is coming up out of the oceans and creating these little puffs, and as that is drifting over to near a continental edge, how it begins to pile up as it meets another current or temperature gradient. Mm. And again, I'm not a weather person. I think a weather person would just have get so much out of a flight in space. Mm. But even as a layperson, you can just get a sense of the mechanics of all this, and it really just makes you really recognize how truly small the Earth is, how really interconnected all these things are, how much pollution is really being dumped into the oceans by rivers or at least silts and other things, and how much particulate matter, smoke from fires is being brought into the atmosphere, and all these things just have many more of these little impressions of the mechanics of the Earth.
There's one thing about space tourism that's always made me wonder, and that is that it's easy to get the impression that in space there isn't actually a whole lot to do. I mean, what did you do at the ISS? What did you on the space station? What were you actually getting up to day in, day out?
Yeah, well, it's worth pointing out that the ISS is now the size of a jumbo jet, and every surface, the floor, the walls, the ceiling, or whichever one you call the floor, the wall, the ceiling, is covered with scientific instruments. And so there is an enormous volume of important work that can really only be done in space. But what's interesting about what I'll call the government approach to doing work in space and what a private citizen can do in space is the government activities are all based on what I'll call fundamental research. You know, just like a super collider is really not making a product for you to buy, you know, they're doing fundamental research. And that's, I think, a worthy investment upon the part of civilization, you know, to invest in those things. However, I'm a big believer that space, you know, if the rest of us, if we're going to build businesses in space, which is what I think will bring more and more people into space, is when there's things to do in space that are directly valuable to humanity in ways you can measure and sell. That's what will kind of open the floodgates. And so what I try to demonstrate that that's possible. And so one of the numerous scientific and commercial activities that I did was one called protein crystal growth. And so I took up about a 1 liter container with about 1,000 little straws in it with protein solutions in them and allowed these proteins to crystallize in space. And the importance of that is you can actually try to grow crystals here on the ground also. But protein molecules are very big and very complex. They crystallize very slowly, and they're on the ground in 1G, they don't come out very pure because even little convection currents during the crystallization process disturb that. But in space, there's no convection currents since there's no up, down, or left, or right. And so the crystals grow larger and more purely. And since there is a unique protein involved in every biological function, and the only way or the best way to get a really accurate structure of those proteins is to grow these crystals in space. That means that from what I call a developing therapeutic drugs, there's enormous value and a virtually unlimited number of proteins to study. We've actually already popped the top on the crystallization container that I took to space. We did get more and larger crystals out of it, but we're now selecting crystals to go do this X-ray diffraction process on.
Can you take us through how it makes you feel different personally when you're in space? I mean, can you pick up on sort of physiological changes? How does it affect you as a person? What does it do to you?
Yeah, you know, so living and working in space is a lot more physiologically challenging than I expected, even having gone through a lot of training on the subject. You know, you hear a lot about what's called space adaptation sickness, which is a fancy way to say motion sickness.
Right.
And so the Russians believe in like this rotating chair exercise that they believe helps defend you against it. The U.S. doesn't generally believe in that. I did it because I trained with the Russians. And by the way, I had no motion sickness. So my sample of one implies that it may have helped. However, I didn't have any problem with that. And I was told by all my crewmates that, you know, compared to almost everybody who takes their first flight into space, I adapted to living and working space very quickly. And of course, I've flown lots of zero-G parabola, so I know what it's like to feel weightless. However, you know, a zero-G parabola only lasts about 30 seconds. And so the first 30 seconds in space feels very much like a zero-G parabola. After about 6 minutes, however, a new physiological change begins to kick in, and that's commonly referred to as fluid shift. And it feels sort of like you're hanging upside down on a set of monkey bars with your head down. And you can feel how the blood begins to rush to your head. And to stay in that, to hang upside down on monkey bars, when you're a kid especially, isn't uncomfortable for a few minutes. But if you stayed that way for 10 minutes, or an hour, or 10 days, it begins to become somewhat of a nuisance. And it makes you basically feel like you've got a head cold. In my case, it also manifested as regular, really severe headaches. And even when I got there and was having these first symptoms, I looked at my crewmates who had been up there for 6 months, and they all still had this puffy face, bloodshot eyes, bulging veins on their face. And I'm going like, well, do you get, you know, I see you've had the same symptoms visually. You've got the same thing I've got. Does it ever go away? And they go, no, you just kind of learn to live with it. And your other things change, like your gastrointestinal system basically shuts down. And so you lose your appetite. It becomes actually hard to consume enough calories to kind of maintain your weight there in the beginning. So I found anyway that it, in spite of how quickly I adapted statistically, I still found the first 4 or 5 days to be really pretty challenging.
And so this presumably is because your heart is used to pumping blood against gravity, and you put you up in space where, okay, gravity's still there, but you're getting rid of the effects of it by sort of being in free fall. Your heart keeps pumping up to your head anyway, regardless. And it doesn't, I'm surprised it doesn't actually click and sort of stop doing that so much that it doesn't readjust.
Well, some parts do. Like, for example, your inner ear, your vestibular function inside your inner ears really does make the adjustment over about 4 or 5 days. The thing about this fluid shift, they believe really comes from the little muscles in your venous system that normally in your legs, constricts to fight gravity, And in space, it all just basically relaxes and, you know, doesn't bother coming to work. And what's interesting is when you get to the ground, you have the reverse problem. Because the blood vessels in your legs are not accustomed to needing to squeeze to keep blood in your head, when you get on the ground, it's not at all uncommon. In fact, it's very common for people to stand up and pass out because the blood leaves their head. Your vestibular system also has gone offline. So even for me, you spend a couple of days, sloshing around like a drunk person trying to stand up. Your nervous system communication with your legs or some level of muscle atrophy, I'm not sure what combination, means that you basically lose the ability to walk. And so people have to actually really support you, and you're lumbering around like your legs weigh a ton, and just to lift them up out of bed and sit up is a real chore. And so it's all kinds of adaptation issues going both ways.
You touched earlier on the journey back, and I think people will be interested in what that's like, sort of psychologically, but also physically. I mean, when you're sat, you have to presumably climb back into the Soyuz capsule. Can you take us through that process? I mean, do you feel yourself being detached? Can you, presumably at this point, you can see the sort of scenery on the way down. What kind of things do you see? What do you feel?
Yeah, so the departure day the departure events happen actually very quickly. In fact, they wait for an orbit where you're over television broadcast capability to kind of wave your goodbyes on the station. And then they want you to get in the Soyuz, seal it up, and undock while you're still capable of broadcasting. So it's actually a kind of a harried goodbye at a time when you're frankly quite sad to be leaving. And so it's that was from a personal standpoint, it really was a very sad time. You scurry in, you seal it up, get in your space suits, you test a few seals, and you issue the command to unlatch. And when the latches release, they have been the two vehicles, the Soyuz and the station itself, have been pulled together by these latches. Mm. So when the latches release, there's springs in there that physically give you an impulse to push you away. And the first thing you do is you actually just sit there for some time and drift away from the space station to not power up your engines and throw your fuel on the outside of the, cake it on the windows and other things of the station itself. And after you basically coast away and change your attitude to prepare for reentry, after a couple hours, you reissue your reentry burn, which only runs for a few minutes to slow you down just enough to where you're no longer going to be in orbit. And then you wait for 10 or 15 minutes to begin to reenter the atmosphere. Just before you reenter the atmosphere, there's another really important event that takes place, which is to separate the descent module that you're going to come to the Earth in from the habitation module that you lived in for 2 days and from the instrument compartment that holds your solar panels and fuel and things you don't need during reentry. Mm. And during the previous two Soyuz reentries, it appears that there was a fault in that separation that made at least two of the components enter the atmosphere together, which of course is not how it's designed to go. And so it caused a rougher ride for the return of the previous two vehicles. And so as we're going through our flight data files, when you get to the page where, it says, okay, here's the separation event, that's at least, for me, was really the only time I really, I wouldn't even call it was worried or terribly concerned. It's just one of those things where you're paying close attention because you realize if this goes well, you're going to have a smooth ride home. If this goes poorly, it's going to be rough and tumble. And having never experienced it before, I didn't know what to expect, what I'll call sounds and physical feelings wise. But there was a single pop, which, I presume was, the disconnection of some cables or pipes, and then two more pops. And the first pop was the separation of the habitation module, and we moved directly backwards away from it, and it felt clearly, there was no angular momentum imparted, so it felt very clean. Second pop was a little push forward, separation of the instrument compartment, also again just very clean. And so that was the moment where you're going like, okay, it's going to be a gentle, relatively speaking, ride home. And right after that, you begin to encounter the atmosphere. You begin to see plasma build up outside the windows, basically fire going by outside the windows. The heat shield begins to ablate. It looks like Roman candles or sparklers going off outside the window. You see bits of tinfoil and other things that are all melting off the side of the capsule that begins to blacken the outside of those windows. And in fact, before the parachutes open, the windows basically become covered with soot.
Right.
In fact, as the thrusters are continuing to orient the capsule, that also seems to be what adds to this blackening on the windows. And then you get to the altitude where the parachutes open. And the parachute deployment is a fairly raucous event. I mean, it's like you're on the end of a whip that's being cracked. And so things get violently, anything's not strapped down is going to get tossed around once inside the space capsule. And shortly thereafter, the heat shields are dropped, which also ejects the outer pane of glass that's been blackened. And so you actually get a chance to see, again, the view. At this point, you're already well within the atmosphere. Couldn't see the parachutes, but again, you could see that now I'm at least now within the atmosphere. And we landed almost precisely, or we came in really right on target. So the helicopters were right there, had us in sight, gave us the countdown from a few kilometers up and told us how we were approaching the ground. So we knew when we were getting ready to touch down. They don't like to use the word impact, but I would describe it also as an impact. The final actual touchdown, you're in about a 6-ton, metal object below this gigantic parachute. And when it encounters the ground at what, I don't actually remember the speed, but it feels like about a 30-mile-an-hour car crash. And, so it's a very hard, very violent strike. And you kind of bounce and roll for almost 30 seconds exactly. But we actually hit the ground 500 meters from the calculated prediction. And so there was all the ground forces were right there. We literally almost landed on top of them. And so as soon as we quit bouncing and rolling, I mean, within less than 10 seconds of bouncing and rolling, there was a tap, tap, tap on the window because they were right there. And they rolled the capsule over onto an angle that would help them with the door. They had a hand crank, obviously, in hand before they jumped out of their vehicles to come open it. And they popped that door open and started dragging us out. It was like instantaneous.
What did it feel like to be walking again on the ground? I mean, is it easy enough to walk around when you're back?
No, actually, you can't walk around when you're back. In fact, even for me, just having been up for 12 days, you have people kind of helping you, and you try to move your legs and try to help, and you realize, I really can't. And they quickly put you in a chair, and they basically carry you around. And my crewmates, who had been up for 6 months, had even more serious 1G adaptations. It's a nice way to say they got sick. They were feeling very ill immediately. Right. Upon finding themselves back in 1G, and that's not at all uncommon.
So now you're back. Do you plan to stay sort of heavily involved in the space industry, or is that it for you now?
Well, no, I'm still, I'm vice chairman of the board of Space Adventures, and, so I still plan to remain actively involved. And especially now that I've done this, I really think not only can I advise Space Adventures as to how we might do a better job of this in the future, but I also think I have, what I'll call new insights as to how to do business in space and how to, help make space not just accessible to the wealthy, but really to build bridges that will allow, more and more people to live and work in space in the future.
Can't help noticing you've got lots of sort of vials and things around you still. I mean, what's all this about? You've got tags on your wrists?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm still wearing a special watch that has a motion sensor and a light meter in it so that it monitors my wake and sleep patterns. I've got little test tubes and syringes, or not syringes, little stoppers that I use to collect spittle, basically, from my mouth. They're using for an immune study. I'm doing some motion perception, forms. And so I'm still, for about another 2 weeks, I'll be doing medical tests that I began long before I flew, all throughout flight, and back here on the ground.
And you're back just in time for the election. Are you looking forward to getting your vote in?
I actually already did. I voted absentee. I was actually hopeful I might be in space still during the election so I could vote from space. But I knew at least I wouldn't be back in the States. So I have voted absentee.
Is it unfair to ask you which way it went?
I happen to be an Obama fan at the moment, so that's where my personal vote went. But of course, we'll have to wait for a few more days really to see how the national elections go.
Really good to see you back.
Great to be here. Thanks.